Welcome to the Words Matter Pod. My name is Akil Pinnock. For first-time listeners, welcome. And to those who've tuned in before, welcome back. I appreciate all of you, and I'm not just saying that. I really do mean it with deepest sincerity. It's humbling to know that people take the time out of their day to listen, view, like, comment, subscribe, and rate this podcast in this large sea of podcasts. A lot has been going on. I moved to Los Angeles, California from New York, where I'm building a home with my girlfriend. And I like LA, it's pretty cool. She was here already, so it only made sense for me to follow. I've been here for about 5 months, and I'm using my time wisely, reaching out to potential guests and interviewing people in person as well as virtually, and just coming up with new things to add to the podcast to keep things fresh. I don't know when y'all will listen to this episode, but the day of this release, February 28th, marks the one-year anniversary of the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock. You know, I had to finish Black History Month strong. And I'm happy that y'all have been on this ride with me, and I'm looking forward to y'all staying on this ride with me. I'm learning a lot about this industry, this technology, social media, YouTube, Google, computers, MacBooks, SD cards, cameras, you name it. Because, you know, even though I'm a millennial, I'm not the most tech-savvy guy, but stepping into this world has taught me a lot, and thank you to everyone along the way who has helped me with the information, with the formation of this podcast as well, because I can't do everything by myself. I know some of y'all listening are probably like, why is he doing all this talking before the episode even started? He never used to do this. And I get it, because I hate when I'm listening to a podcast and the intro is 10 minutes plus. I don't care about your life, bro. But in all seriousness, I want to be transparent to everyone and give y'all a reason for my hiatus, because people have been asking me where I've been at, especially after releasing an episode every week from the last week of February last year through mid-September. But anyway, enough about me. Let's get into today's episode. Last month, I had the pleasure of interviewing then-senior reporter for Law and Crime News, Megan Cuniff. In a time where anything uploaded online can be labeled as news, Cuniff's fair and unbiased coverage of the people of the state of California versus Daystar Peterson, aka Tory Lanez, made her a viral star, affectionately earning the moniker Megan the Reporter. In this episode, we discuss the importance of minimizing harm when putting out stories, false narratives surrounding the trial, reporting accurate information, embracing new journalistic mediums, and more. Much respect to you, Megan, for keeping journalism alive. Please rate, comment, and subscribe. This podcast is available to listen wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock, a podcast dedicated to storytellers. I'm here with Megan Cuniff, who, while covering the Tory Lanez trial, where he was charged and now convicted of shooting Megan Thee Stallion, she became a viral sensation in the Black Twitter community for her fair and unbiased coverage of the trial as senior reporter for Law and Crime News, affectionately earning the moniker Megan the Reporter. Her credentials include Law.com, Los Angeles Daily Journal, the Orange County Register, and various daily newspapers in Idaho and Washington. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
I'm great, man. Once again, you know, thank you for allowing me to interview you.
Absolutely.
And everyone, we appreciate your coverage of the trial and the aftermath as well.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to keep following it. I'm hoping to have something maybe next week on, you know, what Tory's doing and kind of what his next steps are. So,
yeah. So, you know, this is going to be primarily about the trial, but, you know, also I think that this entire timeline of your coverage is just a great exhibition in like what journalism is and the designation between journalism and blogging. Not like there's anything wrong with blogging, but, you know, sometimes the lines get blurred and certain personal agendas and feelings get intertwined in whoever the defendant is and whoever, whoever is the victim. So
yeah,
exactly. So who are you?
My name's Megan. I grew up in Oregon, Corvallis, Oregon, and went to school at University of Oregon, was always interested in journalism and worked for my high school paper. And Corvallis is where Oregon State is. So sometimes I get questions like, why didn't you go to Oregon State? But, you know, who wants to go to college in their hometown? And then a big thing was University of Oregon has a journalism program. So I was interested in doing that. So I worked for the college paper and then got an internship through the university with a paper in Bend, Oregon, and did that. Went back to college for my final term and then went up to Spokane, Washington, and worked at the paper up there and was able to get some experience up there. So that was kind of when I first started covering courts and kind of the police beat and that kind of thing.
Okay. So I wanted to, you know, before we go more to your story, are you familiar with the SPJ, Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics?
Yeah. We learned about that and, you know, kind of familiarized myself with it when we were in college. And I still have the ethics, a little handy sheet of the ethics code around somewhere. But yeah, that was kind of driven home to us. And then the Spokesman Review is kind of had the traditional newspaper background. And, you know, I was the youngest reporter by far. So there were a lot of like in-house rules and in-house guides that I paid attention to, too.
Yeah. So what exactly from that code of ethics do you hold the nearest and dearest to you? I mean, I know all of them are important.
One thing I think is really important that I think of a lot is minimize harm. Like you want to find a balance between what is the benefit to the public and then what is the harm to, you know, an individual that this might come out. And I think that you see that a lot, like in court cases and how you cover stuff, because, you know, just because it's out in the public realm doesn't mean that, you know, you need to put it out there more and that kind of thing. You're kind of weighing, you know, what is the benefit to the public of their understanding of the case, and what are these details kind of add to your understanding of the case versus, you know, is it just kind of a sensational detail that's just being thrown out there for, you know, clicks, that kind of thing.
And how important is that code of ethics to you, and, you know, how often do you incorporate it into your work as a journalist on a regular basis?
I think it's really important, and I think it's kind of one of those things where if you have that in mind and you've been kind of raised through that, like it almost is like second nature. Like hopefully you get to a point in your career where you're not like, you know, actually having to like take out the code and like read it yourself. Like it's just kind of a way of operating in a way that you kind of get to know how to kind of read situations through the years, and you can kind of always incorporate that into your reporting, hopefully.
You cover a lot of law and crime related stories. Did you ever want to work in law or practice law or in law enforcement?
Yeah, I've always been interested in lawyers. My dad was a criminal defense lawyer, and his brother, my uncle's was a lawyer, and then his son, my cousin's a lawyer over on the East Coast. So it definitely kind of runs in the family. But I was always interested in journalism and kind of how it intersects with law, in that, you know, you're fact focused, that kind of thing. And then the storytelling aspect of, you know, journalism versus trial lawyers, that kind of thing. And then I was very interested in actually being a legal journalist, because, you know, a lot of lawyers, I mean, they love court, but they're so focused on only their cases. Like a lot of people tell me they're kind of jealous that I get to see so many different trials, because, I mean, even a really experienced trial attorney will do, you know, a number of trials a year, but it's not like they have time to go sit in on other people's trials and just sit there all day watching it. So, you know, you get to see a lot of different things and kind of learn a lot of different things about lawyers in the legal community that you might not actually get if you were practicing law.
What are those things?
Just like how different judges operate and how different lawyers operate, and then kind of how different trials run. Because, I mean, you just kind of hear the fundamental bedrocks of, like, you know, respecting jurors' times, not wasting any time for the jury, and judges who really do a lot of trial prep with the attorneys ahead of time to get them prepared so there aren't any kind of, you know, sidebars or downtime and that kind of thing. It's just the different approaches that judges can take to kind of make trials run, you know, smoothly. Because I kind of noticed it with the Tory Lanez trial, like the way it went on for so long, because it just seemed like it was such a stressful, volatile thing in people's lives. And, you know, every day of trial, there was all this coverage, you know, here's what happened in the Tory Lanez trial today, all over the blogs. And it was just, I mean, Megan testified about it. Kelsey testified about it, about how nobody wants to be involved in the case at all. And it seemed like it could have been like a 3 or 4 day trial. Like if he'd started testimony at 8 or 9 a.m. and gone the full day, we would have just been there that week instead of having it like stretch on for 10 days. Because as that was happening, you know, tensions were just kind of rising in the courtroom and everyone's just getting kind of fatigued and stressed. And it was almost just this kind of like unnecessary stress on the case that you didn't need. If you just had, you know, a normal trial schedule, you could have had it done in 3 or 4 days. But so, you know, having experience like that, it just kind of gives me the perspective of that. And I know the judge was doing it because he has so many other cases that he wanted to do hearings in the morning and that kind of thing. So you kind of have the ability to just kind of like read the courtroom like that and then kind of anticipate like what the argument could be. And then, you know, what the lawyers are going to be doing in court and, you know, where they should be going with their case. It's kind of fun.
I mean, yeah, I did want to bring that up because I saw some of your earlier tweets covering the trial. You said that it was going to last 5 to 7 days, and then it ended up lasting 12 days.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that was, that was the Lanez trial. It was predicted at 5 to 7 days, but you know, things always happen with witnesses and things going longer than we thought, but you know, he was supposed to start at 10:30 a.m. And this is the only court that I report in where there's like a big process for journalists to be seated in the courtroom. You have to like sign your name on a clipboard, line up, you're all kind of file in. And I'd like to see a pilot program at this court where a judge just lets the public walk into the courtroom and sit down and see how long it takes, because it seems like it's just a longer process to have this bailiff like kind of herding us into the courtroom and talking to us like we're 5-year-olds, that kind of thing. So it kind of delays it. And then we all sit there and it's like, okay, it's 10:40. We're supposed to start at 10:30. What's going on? And there's stuff going on back in chambers where a lot of other judges would have like made sure to have this all, you know, taken care of beforehand before the jury's there. But it's also easier said than done. We don't really know what is coming up back there. So it's like finally 11:15 and we get started. And as somebody said to me, oh, it's just in time for lunch, because the court has to take a mandatory break, 90-minute break at noon, from noon to 1:30. So we finally get started with testimony. This happened with Megan's testimony. She finally starts testifying at about, I think, 11:15 or 11:20. And she goes for 40 minutes and then they have to take a break for 90 minutes. And 40 minutes of her testimony got her right to the point. She was almost to the point of the shooting, like the really dramatic stuff. And we had to take a break for 90 minutes and she came back. So I think a lot of judges, the way they handle trials, would try to schedule it so that her testimony isn't interrupted like that. But it's just kind of, I mean, it's kind of an aside and like kind of technical things that I noticed, but it really like affects how the trial runs and that kind of thing. But
yeah.
I
mean, what, like, all right, so are there any kind of like what setbacks will happen with just with the trial dragging out that long? Like what I'm not even sure how to even word that. Like, are there any other just like ramifications for it like dragging out that long? Or
I think one basic concern for people is when you're dealing with jurors like that is in you're in flu season is COVID. I mean, COVID, and then also just in general, anytime you have a trial stretching on that long and every day, you know, 14 people are expected to go to the courthouse, and if they don't show up, it's going to be a problem. You just kind of run the risk that something is going to happen in those people's lives. Like somebody is going to get sick, or there's going to be a death in the family or something where people don't feel like they can be in the trial anymore. And it could lead to a mistrial, like if you somehow get under 12 jurors. But that's why they impanel alternates. So you only need 12 people to decide the case. But most of the time you have, I think they started with 15 jurors total. So you've got 3 who are kind of on the side and can sub in just in case something happens. So anytime you have a trial just stretching on like that, it just leads to, you know, it increases the risk that something is going to happen and a juror is going to have to drop out, or you know, something going on with the defendant, and then just kind of the tension around the courthouse, the people who show up, and the fatigue on the lawyers and the court staff and that kind of thing. And then just the fact that the jurors have to go to court, you know, for 10 days straight and only hear 3.5 hours of testimony a day when they could go to court for 4 days straight and hear 5 hours of testimony a day or something. But
so if, you know, say in this trial, one of the jurors dropped out, then what do you think the verdict would be?
It's hard to say because, they would still be have to deliberate like they did, with Tori, they did 7 hours over 2 days. They did have an alternate juror, or I think it was a sitting juror before the deliberations began. One of the jurors was excused. They didn't say why, but you know, it was probably a scheduling thing or something. So an alternate did sub in and, they started deliberating together. I've seen cases where like if for some reason a juror in the middle of deliberations has to be excused or something, like they're not going to be deliberating anymore, and then they move an alternate in, they would technically have to start deliberations all over again. They would be told that, like, the 11 people who remain, they're like, okay, you have a new person in here now. That means the discussion that you had with this other person, you have to like put that all aside and start over. And because there's nobody else really in the jury room to monitor them, I think it's kind of, some people don't think they actually do that, like start over the discussion. And the yeah. idea that, you know, one person can come in to 11 people who have already been discussing something and it would just be a clean slate is kind of unreasonable. But technically, they're told that they need to start deliberating all over again. But we didn't see that in Tori's case because the 12 jurors who started deliberating, they continue deliberating and are the ones who came up with the verdicts. So the two alternates never subbed in.
Okay. Do you see any parallels between practicing law and journalism as far as the ethics and the principles you're expected to have?
Yeah, definitely. It's the same kind of fact gathering and, you know, trying to get to the root and trying to figure out how to read an issue quick and sum it up in a good way, that accessible way for the public that people can understand. It's kind of the same thing because journalists do that with complicated topics like a court hearing or something, whereas lawyers, trial lawyers especially, do that on like just a bigger scale with kind of telling the narrative of their case and kind of figuring out how to present it to the jury. So yeah, I think in terms of storytelling and just fact finding, they're very similar.
Yeah. That's something that I observed myself, like just what conclusion I came to myself, like it seemed very similar, just speaking to different attorneys.
Yeah.
At Law and Crime, you covered a lot of celebrity cases in the greater LA area. And are there any commonalities with all of these celebrity cases, or is it just the same as any other low profile trial, I guess?
I mean, the procedure and a lot of the stuff can be the same, but there's definitely something to be said for just the increased media attention that adds to a case. And sometimes you'll notice that it almost seems like lawyers will kind of, you know, they're obviously paying attention to the media coverage. And sometimes you can kind of see how their case is kind of like responding to that. Whereas, you know, some lawyers think that you really just need to focus on the case and not worry about outside publicity. Anytime you have a case with a lot of outside publicity, I think it's natural that they're going to be paying attention to that a little bit. So they're somewhat driven by public opinion on that. But also, if they just kind of focus on their case and the facts, they can kind of keep their head down and stay away from that and keep going.
Yeah. I mean, how do you approach these cases, these high profile cases, without sounding like a gossip blogger?
And, you know, part of it is I think it's just my background of, you know, how I was brought up in reporting. Like when I was working at the Spokesman Review, you know, and I was the night cops reporter, I was writing a lot of, you know, short, quick stories on like a convenience store robbery or a car crash or something like that. So you just kind of learn how to approach a situation like that. Whereas what's the most important thing? I mean, it's like the inverted pyramid style of a news story, you know, and you kind of just learn how to go to meetings and court hearings and kind of approach everything like that, because you're just trying to get out what is the most basic news for people. Because I mean, so many times you'll turn something on and it's a report or And they just don't get to the point. Like there's something to be said for, and working in traditional newsrooms will kind of teach you how to do this, how to quickly focus in on what the news is. You know, like if you get a court document that's 8 pages long and it details all the steps about, you know, a murder case or something. And I'm thinking about the case in Idaho where a guy was just arrested for the murder of the 4 students up there. And the affidavit came out and it had all the details about why he was arrested. And it's the journalist's job to kind of take that affidavit and not only just put it out to the public, but actually make sense of it. And if you're writing a story about it, I mean, what is your story going to look like? And I noticed it, and I think this would be the news, is how they caught him. And a lot of people led with the DNA on the knife sheath, because there were a lot of details in there about him wearing all black and, you know, stalking the people inside the home. One of the girls had woken up or something and seen him, and all that is, of course, important and in the story. But it's kind of like, what is the main news for the public here about why this guy was arrested? And it's because they found his DNA on the knife sheath. So I noticed that a lot of news organizations, like, that was their headline about the probable cause affidavit. But then when you read their story, it gets into all the other details. But it's like things like that, that, you know, kind of any story, if you're doing that early in your career and learning how to cover like a school board meeting or a police press conference about a convenience store robbery, you can translate that into court cases later on, like more complicated issues. It kind of gives you the foundation you need to just go into a situation and just kind of focus on what's important.
Yeah. Cutting out the fat.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There's narrative surrounding trials in cases. Do you think that, like, the narrative surrounding high profile celebrity cases are the same as cases that don't involve famous people?
I think it varies. I think there's, you know, definitely more of a chance that you're having a narrative when it's a high profile case, because sometimes when it's a, you know, no one's really covering the case, I mean, there's not really a chance for any kind of coverage or like public opinion to form from it. So it's the high profile cases where that stuff kind of seeps in and really, really starts to, you know, be visible.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, there's been so many different narratives, you know, tweets, Instagram comments, different bloggers, conspiracy theories, who, you know, even people who question the validity of Megan's claims that Tori shot her.
That was one thing I was surprised when I was covering the trial. It took me like a day of kind of sitting in there to realize that the fact that Tori's lawyer admits that Megan was shot was actually like big news. I mean, no lawyer would actually get up there and argue she wasn't shot when there's like x-rays of her foot and a surgeon testifying. But I was just surprised that so many people like in the kind of Twitter sphere really latched on to just that fact that he was admitting that she was shot. It's like, wow, there really just seems to be a lot of misinformation out about it for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, you know, like even like her sexual history was brought up in the music business, and it was brought up by the defense. And, you know, even though that has nothing to do with what she was on trial for, you know, as the public, we have access to her friend's text message record saying that she texted security saying that Megan was shot. And even in 2020, there was a Shade Room comment, Shade Room post. And in the comments, someone said, people saying Kelsey shot her. And then Tory Lanez replied to that comment saying, that's not true. And then after the verdict, phone audio from the county jail was released where Tory Lanez repeatedly apologized to Megan's former friend, Kelsey. And then you yourself said that, you can verify that it's true. So with all that information, why do you feel like it was so hard for many to believe that he was guilty?
And I think part of it is a lot of that stuff wasn't out. I did hear that like the text message, the apologetic text message that Tori sent Meg had been out and seen for a couple of years, but like the phone call that Kelsey did, I don't think that was out before trial. So nobody had really heard that before. And then just the collection of evidence that the police had, you know, the x-rays of her foot, the shell casings that they picked up. There's a video of her in the ambulance, Megan in the ambulance afterward. And then there's also, and I think this came out with the TMZ video of them all outside the car, but of Kelsey talking to Megan after the shooting when police have them like stopped on the sidewalk and she walks by Megan or Megan walks by her and she says something to her like, are you okay? Or something like that. That was shown in court. So all that stuff. And I think it's the totality of it all too. You know, it's not like just one piece of evidence here and there. It's when you're in a courtroom and you put all that together. And then it's kind of one of those cases that really comes together in closing arguments because the attorneys have the opportunity to do an opening statement where some people call those opening arguments. You'll see that a lot, but legally you shouldn't call it an opening argument because they're not supposed to argue anything. They get up there and they say what they think the evidence is going to be. And then the trial is them getting all their evidence in through their exhibits. And then testimony is also evidence. And then closing arguments are when they actually argue what they think the evidence shows. So they can say, you know, you take all this stuff, it shows that, you know, Tori shot Megan, which is what prosecutors said. So it seemed like one of those cases to me that it would really come together in closings. And a lot of these cases do because, you know, opening statement was a while ago and the jurors have heard a lot of evidence since then. And they had the phone call in the beginning and they heard it again when somebody from the jail came and testified to get it in evidence. But it was in closing argument when they really heard it again. And that was when the prosecutor was really able to go through it like line by line. So, I mean, it's like the totality of the evidence that can really sink you, you know?
Yeah. But do you honestly believe that, you know, even if people had earlier access to some of that evidence, or I guess some people don't even consider evidence, just, you know, details, whatever. Do you think that people would still just believe what they wanted to believe regardless of the facts?
Yeah. I mean, I do think there are some people out there like that. I think there was a huge crowd and I think that's why people kind of paid attention to my reporting is they just wanted the facts on it. But there's always kind of people on all sides who it's not that they, you know, aren't literate and can't read this stuff. It's just, they're kind of malicious about it. You know, they have an agenda that they're going to promote one way or the other. But I think you kind of get that in any case. And it's not the majority of people either. I think the majority of people, you know, really just wanted to know what was going on and they can kind of overshadow and overpower the people who are taking sides.
Yeah. Do you think that as a journalist, you, might have a little bit more optimism than the average person because, you know, you're putting out this factual information. You're trying to be as credible as possible and reliable as possible. But, you know, some people just want to be entertained. They could care less.
Yeah.
If it's true.
Yeah,
or false.
I've definitely seen that. Like you kind of wonder about like how much they're actually reading it or I mean, whether they're kind of comprehending it in the way that, you know, you'd think it would be. But you know, that's just kind of up to people. And one thing I was told early on by an editor and it was in response to when you're doing like math in a story, like you don't need to do the math for the reader. And it's like, don't insult the reader's intelligence. And that's what I kind of try to remember. It's like, don't try to appeal to like the lowest common denominator of your readership, you know, like try to have faith in people's intelligence and, you know, us as a society as our ability to like kind of shift through stuff. And hopefully the people who do that kind of overpower the malicious people who are using facts to kind of just try to distort their views, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I think, you know, being a defense attorney it could be a slippery slope because you look at the O.J. Simpson trial and Robert Kardashian was on his team. And then, you know, later, like after the trial, he kind of had doubts about if O.J. was actually not guilty. So, you know, that just leads me into my next question with just like you, do you think that Tory's team actually believe the things that they were saying, or do you think they were just trying to pull arguments from anywhere to defend him by any means?
You know, I'm not sure. I really don't know. Cause I mean, it would be, I mean, whether they actually believe it or not is not, I mean, I couldn't really say for sure, but it seemed like, I mean, one thing just seemed preparation on their part. I don't think they'd been on the case for very long, so they hadn't done all that much preparation, but, you know, I'm not sure what they really believed or if they were just kind of playing to the cameras on a lot of that stuff. I think a lot of it was really driven to like the public message and playing toward the public message for sure.
Yeah. Your coverage of the trial on Twitter was just as popular as a lot of hip hop blogs who have more followers than you. You know, what about your coverage do you think separated it from the blogs and whose coverage leaned in favor or just flat out insulted Megan?
And I think part of it was just the fact that I didn't do that. And, you know, somebody was, I saw some Twitter comments talking about, you know, why are all these people, you know, paying attention to these, you know, courthouse reporters who don't know anything about the case. And somebody was like, well, the courthouse reporters aren't calling the black woman victim a hoe. Like, I mean, that's kind of, I mean, you know, and it's like, yeah, I mean, we would never, I mean, that's just the people who cover that. That's just kind of, I mean, we would never do that kind of thing. So, and then just the, I mean, one advantage I have is, like I was saying, the background that I have writing about convenience store robberies, that kind of thing, it gives you the ability to kind of quickly process things and report it out. And then, you know, there's something to be said for just the process of going to the courthouse every day, you know, going down to the courthouse, going through security, getting up there. If you haven't done it ever, I mean, it can be kind of, that can just be kind of a shock to your system. I mean, you're in a new place kind of thing, so it affects how you work. But courthouse reporters, especially me, I'd been going up there for like 2 months covering different trials, so I was definitely in a routine of just going to that courthouse every day, so I knew the procedure, I knew all the people there. It wasn't any kind of like new environment for me. So I think, well, those might seem kind of minor, they do kind of factor in for, you know, a reporter going to a new environment is, it's just not as comfortable as somebody who's been there forever. But also, I mean, I think part of it was just the ability to, you know, quickly discern what's going on and then boil it down into quick readable tweets that were engaging and that people thought were informative.
Yeah. I mean, Twitter isn't a newspaper. Twitter isn't a news television show, and you were trained in traditional journalism. So how is it easy or difficult to take the principles and the ethics that you learned being a trained journalist and bring it to Twitter?
Yeah, it is. And one advantage I have again is when we were up in Spokane, when I was up in Spokane at the paper there, I was actually one of the, in 2008, we tweeted a trial. It was right when Twitter had first started and people were kind of getting into, you know, sharing stuff on there. And we, the editor of the Spokesman Review, was really into innovation and that kind of thing. And he wanted us to try that for a trial, to try, you know, having somebody in the courtroom reporting and doing the traditional stories, and then somebody else would be doing the Twitter feeds. So there was a really big, it was actually a federal death penalty case in Boise in 2008, I think it was 2008 or 2009. And I went down to Boise and was in the media room, listening to the feed and doing a Twitter feed while the other reporter was actually in the courtroom. So it was like in the very beginning days of Twitter, and I met somebody else. There was a reporter in Kansas who was tweeting trials at that time, and we kind of got to know each other and then ended up working at the Spokesman or at the Orange County Register together. But he just commented on all the attention I was getting for the Lanes trial. And he's like, you know, you've been working your whole career for this. It's like, do you remember when we were started tweeting trials in the beginning and people were laughing at us about it, you know, but now it's like what everyone does. It's the mainstream kind of thing. So I feel fortunate in that I worked at papers that like kind of embraced that stuff, because we did it in 2008 for that death penalty trial. And then again in 2011, there was a police officer in Spokane who actually went on trial, federal trial, for civil rights violations. He'd like killed some mentally ill guy for no reason and lied to investigators about it and ended up being convicted. And the trial was a really big deal, obviously, in Spokane. It got moved to Yakima because of pretrial publicity. So we had a reporter down in Yakima in the courtroom writing stories, and then I was listening to the feed and doing a live Twitter feed, and it was, people were really responsive to it. There was a lot of kind of hesitancy about Twitter. I mean, just the name of it is kind of silly and it kind of sounds like kind of cheap, like you're cheapening the news and just doing, you know, little sound bites about it. And but actually there was kind of a debate. When I went over to the courthouse in 2011 to start tweeting the first day of the trial, apparently there was a debate in the newsroom about whether I should be doing that. And there was apparently one reporter who was really adamant that he thought it was just a stupid, cheap way of doing journalism, and that we were doing a disservice to ourselves by doing that kind of coverage when we should be directing people to like our main coverage. But after 2 hours of me doing it, when I came back to the lunch break, he actually came up to me and apologized to me, even though it's not like I was in the newsroom when he was saying that. But he realized he was wrong when I started tweeting it, because it was such a big trial and there was so much interest in it. And he realized it was addicting. He was like, I can't turn away from this Twitter feed. I'm addicted to it. And he just realized he was totally wrong to say we shouldn't be doing that. So it was just kind of interesting to look back and realize that that was like the beginning days of social media coverage and you know, what it all came into now. And I think one problem for newspapers is still just monetizing that, because it's like, you know, it's almost kind of a relief sometimes when judges say we can't live transmit from the courtroom, because it's like, okay, maybe we can all just spend time writing for those websites that actually pay us, you know. But Twitter is, I mean, all the traffic's on Twitter. So I think the idea is, and what I'm going to be doing, you know, over the next, you know, phase in my career, is really trying to like utilize all this traffic and bring it to a news website. And you have, you know, all these people on Twitter, how can you get them onto your website? And it's kind of an audience building thing. Whereas if you build an audience and then you can give them a link to a story, you just built, you know, drove way more traffic to your website than you could have before.
Yeah. And it's like it's a form of advertising as well, because you can post a headline in a tweet and then the link to the article, and you know, over time technology advanced to where you see like a preview of the article in the tweet. So you know, it brings that traffic, like you said, it brings that traffic to the website.
Yeah, definitely. So it's kind of finding a balance between, you know, just putting everything on Twitter and having stories. I would remind myself, and I saw some people say on the Tory Lanez stuff that, well, you know, they love the tweets, they really like the stories too, which was a good reminder that, you know, tweets are important, but I almost try to think of it as like note-taking.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, like, at the end of the day, when you sit down to write your story, you have all these tweets that you can kind of just go through and use for quotes and to put together your actual article. And I think that is a big benefit for people, because one reason newspapers died, other than just print publication, is the time that people have. Like, we're all so busy and we don't feel like we have time to do anything anymore. And that was actually when I was interning at that paper in Bend in like 2005, we had some staff meeting and somebody from marketing, the question to the staff was, what is the number one reason that people cancel the newspaper? And I actually won a bulletin visor for the newspaper, because I raised my hand and said they just don't have time to read it anymore. And she said, exactly, that's the reason they hear for all cancellations. And it just goes to how newspapers haven't really kept up with the times for how people consume coverage. Like, everybody wants to go to TikTok and they get like short little TikTok feeds talking about the trial, but it's like, well, how can traditional news figure out a way to fit into that? So Twitter is just like totally optimized to journalism, I feel. But one thing I want to do is figure out a way to bring my content to all the other platforms and social mediums too.
Yeah. You said on your interview on the Higher Learning podcast, it was pretty clear that somebody in Tory's team was sending out a trial transcript or working with some of the social media and YouTube bloggers to try to sway public opinion. But Then when it came time for Tory's lawyers to give his closing argument, he didn't have a PowerPoint, and there were no transcript experts being shown to the jury. Do you feel like his defense team cared more about the court of public opinion than the court of law?
It seemed like it. I mean, and part of it is just, you know, easier said than done. In the end, George was there every day and he did all the speaking parts and he questioned all the witnesses. He did the opening and the closing. And, you know, that's tough to get up there before a jury and be able to do that. But it's also like, I mean, yeah, they had no PowerPoint presentation and they just seemed really focused on the all the hype and all the attention. Like, I mean, I saw him kind of, you know, exchanging glances with this lawyer for workers guy or something.
I know that is.
Like, yeah, it's just like he should be way too busy to be talking to that guy. And yeah, the trial transcripts, I mean, it was obviously somebody who was pro Tory and who'd gotten them and was sharing them, and which is great if they want to do that. But I was like, these trial transcripts had to have come from Tory's lawyers, because the lawyers get those and pay a lot of money for them to, you know, prepare their closing arguments or do motions during trial, that kind of thing. So it was kind of, I thought, pretty telling that you would have trial transcripts like floating out on the internet from Tory's defenders, but you never saw any trial transcripts during the closing argument, which is like kind of the whole point of paying, you know, however many thousands of dollars they paid for those. It might have actually just been a few hundred dollars, but I'm not even sure. But one thing to remember is it's not like, and the Tory's lawyers aren't the ones paying for that. They might be paying for it up front, but they're all putting it on his legal bills. So yeah. I don't know. You just wondered how good his representation actually was on that and what kind of advice he was really getting.
Yeah, it's unfortunate for him, for sure.
Yeah. But I did hear, I hopefully I'll have an article on it next week, but he does have, I did talk to somebody yesterday who said that he's representing him now. He has a new attorney. I haven't confirmed if he's replaced George, but I think there is going to be some new movement on it. It's kind of too late. I mean, it's going to be really hard for him to get a new trial. And if there are things that came up that, you know, maybe the judge made a mistake here or there, I think the totality of it is going to be the problem. Like, an appellate court can say, okay, this was a problem and this was a problem, but it doesn't mean that the jury would have done anything different. So I think he could run into that. Like, if there are issues in his case, you know, the appellate court will still say that, like, the verdict should stand, you know, but we'll see. That's all stuff that's going to come up.
Yeah. So of course people saw Tory Lanez's father in front of the courthouse screaming and alluding to Jay-Z and Roc Nation being responsible for the verdict. I saw commenters in Instagram posts saying that this is some sort of scheme to destroy independent artists, because Megan's music is distributed by a major label and Tory Lanez's music is distributed by an independent distributor. But sidebar, like, he was on a major label when he shot her. But and I saw another conspiracy saying that this was some sort of neo-feminist plot. So what do you think about all of these conspiracies surrounding the case?
I just think they're kind of crazy and just stupid. I mean, those people don't know. I mean, they don't know what they're talking about. I mean, I was alarmed by all the Jay-Z talk, because I'm like, both those people are, I mean, his father and his stepmother, I had some, you know, pleasant interactions with them. You know, I mean, it was cordial and everything. They seem, I mean, they're functioning adults in society, and they really seem to believe. I mean, I'm not sure, but the video of him outside court, I'm like, he's actually a little calmer in that video than he was in the courtroom.
Wow.
Oh yeah. I mean, he just totally erupted, and the deputies were just kind of like, oh God, what do we do? It's like, and then to me, it was just totally predictable. I'm like, yeah, especially the way the verdict came back. I mean, the idea that he would have been declared not guilty was just impossible. I mean, especially if you had looked at the jury, like, during the closing argument, the looks on some of those women's faces. I'm like, there is absolutely no way in hell any of these women would ever vote for not guilty. Mm. Like, if anything, he might be able to get a hung jury. And it was looking like maybe there'll be a hung jury if they're stretching on and asking these questions. But when they came back Friday at 3:15, I think it was 2:45, they announced a verdict. I mean, any experienced defense attorney would tell you, okay, he's going to get convicted. Like, if they have a verdict, he's being convicted on all counts. So if George, their lawyer, was telling them that he might have a chance of getting acquitted, it was kind of irresponsible on his part. But In the end, Tori's dad and his stepmother and he had supporters in there. They saw all the evidence, but some of them seemed really shocked that he was convicted. And I'm not really sure why, because I mean, I thought it was kind of obvious that he was going to be convicted. I mean, whether you see holes in the case or not, just the way everything came in the courtroom, I'm like, I think this guy's pretty sunk. So, the Jay-Z aspect. I mean, one thing I was thinking about was, you know, was Megan with Roc Nation in 2020 when the shooting happened? Because there is that, there is the whole issue of how she at first did not want to say that she was shot at all. Yeah. But then she came forward 4 days later, called the DA's office with her lawyer and said that, you know, yeah, I want to talk about things. So I think there is a chance that, you know, in those 4 days, she had conversations with people around her about, you know, should I tell on Tori or not? And I mean, maybe Jay-Z was one of those people, but the idea that it was any kind of conspiracy is just kind of crazy. I mean, no, it was a bunch of people saying you shouldn't let this guy get away with it. Yeah. You know, I mean, it's not like Jay-Z or anyone in Roc Nation would have had any influence on the prosecutors or anything like that at all. I mean, it would have just been impossible. Perhaps there was a little bit of influence on her just to reiterate that you're doing the right thing by cooperating and testifying against him. But yeah, the idea that there was any conspiracy beyond that, it's totally bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, I think when people, they feel like their back is against the wall, they'll, you know, do anything to kind of justify their reality or why things aren't working in their favor. I think it's just natural.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, them bringing, the kids in there. I mean, when he had his 5-year-old son, I mean, he was there on the first day. And I remember I reported that the son was there, but then I noticed when I was sitting in the courtroom that I didn't see him actually in the courtroom. And I almost thought of it was kind of like a fairness thing to Tori that I should emphasize in the tweets that, you know, while he brought his son to court, I didn't actually see him in the courtroom. Because I think a lot of people, like, their just base assumption is that that's inappropriate, that he's 5 years old and he shouldn't be in the courtroom for something like that. But then the next day was when Megan testified and he was definitely in the courtroom for that. And it kind of gets into, I mean, is it not objective to say that a 5-year-old shouldn't be in the courtroom to hear testimony from the woman that his dad is accused of shooting? I don't know. I mean, in the end, he's not my kid. People can make any kind of decisions that they want like that. But I think there were a lot of kind of things going on with like children in the courtroom and that kind of thing that people just kind of wondered about, you know, and wondered if it was really the most appropriate move. And then also if he was, you know, somebody in his family did say that, you know, he really is just here for support, to support each other. It's not like they're trying to win sympathy from the jury or anything like that. But I think a lot of people were kind of taken aback by them bringing kids into it. I mean, you can see like the video of his dad outside court. There's a, like an 8-year-old girl, like front and center in the whole thing.
Yeah. Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess we would probably never get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, they obviously just are really passionate about it. And, you know, Tori's son, you know, he loves his dad and wants to be there to see him. But I think a lot of people were just like, wow, what a scene to bring kids into.
And then he was brought to jail, like, right after the verdict was reached. So it's like,
yeah.
Did his son see that?
Sorry?
He was brought to jail right after the verdict was reached. So did his son see that?
Yeah, yeah, they were all sitting right there when they handcuffed Tori and took him. Although, you know, it was all chaotic because I think the dad stood up and kind of started carrying on before the actual remand happened. So I think they were actually out of the courtroom when Tori was led out in handcuffs, but they all knew he was being remanded. The judge said, you know, after the verdict was read that he was being remanded. So
I mean, you said his dad, the energy that his dad showed outside the courtroom wasn't even close to what he displayed in the courtroom. So, I mean, what was the overall energy in the courtroom after the verdict was reached, like on both sides?
I mean, it was pretty close. He was probably a little bit angrier in the courtroom, but just it had just happened. And he just got up and screamed like this. I think he said this wicked system stands before God. I can't remember the exact quotes, but it was about the wicked system and the prosecutors knowing what they've done. And he kind of approached him with his finger out and was saying that they're evil and they know exactly what they've done and that they're all going to have to answer to God. Mm.
But what about everyone else? Like, what about just everyone else outside of his dad?
Yeah, there were other people like just kind of agreeing with his father. Like that one woman turned to me and the other reporters and said, you know, Jay-Z's a bitch, report that Jay-Z is a bitch. And then someone behind us kind of lifted up her arm and was saying, you know, in Jesus's name as Tory's dad was yelling. So it got pretty crazy because there just weren't enough deputies in there. I mean, it was Christmas Eve. So the court was a little understaffed. Although if you know most of those deputies, like all the deputies at the courthouse, if they had a chance to be in the courtroom, they would have loved to be there. They all like to be where the action is. So it was definitely just an administrative decision by the courts to only have six deputies in there, which was the same number of deputies they had in there for Weinstein, Harvey Weinstein, who's that movie mogul guy who's like in a wheelchair in 70. I mean, there was really no risk on him, but they had to have people on lanes because he just got remanded and you don't want him to do anything. But then his family, there were just so many of them. And I think his father just has this loud booming voice. I think he's a pastor, experience with that. So I think it just caught a lot of people by surprise. And it's not like, I don't want to make it sound like, oh, they should have had more deputies in there because they needed to use like force or something, because they absolutely didn't. It's not like he was being violent with anybody. I think people were kind of afraid he was going to be, but they just needed a bunch of deputies in there to like make him get out of the courtroom. You know, I mean, they didn't need to use, they wouldn't have needed to use any force on him. And I actually heard him say at one point, don't push me, but it would have just been a lot easier for them to control it if they'd had more deputies in there. But
yeah. I feel like a major detail in the trial that's rarely brought up is that Tory Lanez didn't testify on his behalf. So
I think everyone has a chance to testify in their own trial. It would have been, I think, pretty bad decision for him to testify. I mean, I don't think a lot of people thought that he would have. His lawyer kind of indicated to me in the beginning of the trial that he might, but he could have gotten up there and answered all his lawyer's questions in kind of a nice way, but then the prosecutors would have been able to get up there and do cross-examination, and they can ask him, the questions can be leading, whereas his lawyer would have to ask him open-ended questions. In cross, you can ask leading questions, so the questions are a little more biting, and they would have been able to ask him about the Cap music video where he is, you know, chopping up horse legs, some other lyrics that he's written about Megan. I mean, it would have been a disaster for him, I think. Yeah. And just the way his lawyer seemed to be kind of green on the case, like he came in kind of early, I doubt they would have had a much time to prepare him. So the risk, I mean, it was one of those cases where the benefit to him testifying, it's like, maybe he could get up there and charm the jury and they would, you know, kind of, he might win some people over, but the risk was so great that like he would say something he didn't mean to say, or the prosecutors would kind of badger him into saying something, or it would have been pretty reckless for him to testify. So I definitely think he made the right decision not to testify.
But so do you think that, like, I mean, if he testified or not, like, would that affect the verdict? Like, even if, you know, even if he testified, you thought it would be worse, but he would still was found guilty and he didn't testify. So it's like, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Almost. Yeah. I mean, and that's what I thought, you know, maybe he'll just think, you know, what the heck, maybe I should just go for it. But you know, the risk of it is so great. And I'm not sure how it would have affected the verdict, but I think most people would overall agree that it was probably a good idea. It was the best decision to not testify. That he really didn't have a lot to gain from that, and he had a lot to lose from it.
Yeah. Why was it important to put out accurate information about the case?
Well, I think it just goes to, you know, people want to know what's going on in court, and you know, the way our court system is, it's so mysterious to a lot of people. And then, I mean, a lot of people just think that if you're a lawyer, you just know everything about everything, you know, and there's no kind of rating system or quality system for lawyers. And I was just talking to another really good lawyer on a case the other day about some of the crap lawyering that's going on and on the other side in her case. And of course she's a little biased because she's advocates against them, but she just said, there's so many bad lawyers out there. It's like, yeah. And I wonder, and this is just me spitballing here, but kind of the generational wealth kind of thing, the way lawyers, especially, it's a very generational thing. I mean, a lot of people, like if your parents were lawyers, you know, you have a much better chance of becoming a lawyer. And a lot of these people, I mean, the rich kids who went to private school and, you know, had all their school paid for and never really had to work much in their life. When those people become lawyers, I'm not really sure they make the best lawyers, you know, but those are few and far between. I mean, the profession is still filled with a lot of people, really smart people who have worked really hard to be there. But a lot of the times you just like the focus on the client isn't really there. And I think George McDeesian is not, I mean, he's not one of the ones I'm kind of lumping in with this, but you saw that with Tory's case too, just kind of the lack of preparation in court and the kind of infatuation with the media coverage of it. And, you know, him going off about Kylie Jenner and, oh, I need to talk to Kylie Jenner's lawyer and that kind of thing. It's, I mean, he didn't even call her to testify, you know, but.
Yeah. So are you kind of alluding to, you know, back to what you were saying with a lot of like generational attorneys? Do you think that because they have to, they kind of benefit off nepotism more, that they're worried more about just the look of them being a lawyer rather than actually doing the work?
Sometimes, yeah, you can see that. And there's so many like different types of law, like transactional law, that kind of thing, whereas like actual courtroom law, like I saw a joke that that guy with the Oath Keepers, one of the Oath Keepers guys who went on trial in DC for the January 6th attack, he's actually a Harvard law graduate, if you could believe that. And there was a joke on Twitter that said, this is the closest a Harvard law grad is ever going to get to a jury trial. And that's kind of a joke within the profession, because those Ivy Leaguers who, you know, are super rich and that kind of thing, they don't know how to connect with the jury, you know, like regular people in court. They don't know how to connect with them, and then they don't know how to present a case at all. I was just talking to some lawyers who just took over a case that's going to trial soon, and they were talking about how for the last 2 years it's been handled by attorneys who don't know how, who've never done a trial before. So they weren't thinking in trial mode, and they were being really defensive, and they weren't thinking about things like exhibits. So right now the attorneys were telling me that they have like 1,000 exhibits to like sort through and try to figure out what is actually going to go before a jury. Cause you have to realize that, you know, 12 people are going to need to sort out this case. Like what are the evidence things that you're going to get admitted and give to them? And I can, sorry, that was kind of, got into a little weeds there, but you just see it a lot in all different areas.
Yeah. So what has this trial taught you or reminded you about the world?
I think it was a big reminder about how insulated you can kind of get in the media world and the courts. I mean, courts reporters and like, do we cover what people are actually interested in? And because so many people were covering Harvey Weinstein, which of course, right? It's a big case and I was covering it. It's not like anyone should stop covering that. But there wasn't so much attention to the Tory Lanez case. And a lot of, and myself included, just kind of talking about it with other reporters, we were kind of like, I mean, we'd all heard of Megan Thee Stallion, but we were kind of like, this is kind of a low-level assault case. Like, is it really that big a deal? None of us realized how much huge interest there was in the public. And part of it is, I mean, I'll just admit it, that it's, you know, white reporters versus, you know, non-white populations. It's like, do we kind of have an overrepresentation in media. And then because of that, maybe we're not totally aware of all the issues going on that really, really interest other communities and non-white communities. And it was a really big thing for me to realize how much attention there was on this, and the fact that I didn't even really realize how much attention there was going to be on it. I mean, it was kind of like a soul searching thing for me, where it's like, wow, I live a really, you know, white sheltered existence. It kind of affects, you know, what I choose to cover.
Yeah. Are you a hip hop fan?
I am a little. So somebody did joke, an old friend was like, I saw a gangster meme of you on Twitter, and I'm so glad that you finally become the gangster you always wanted to be. Like, but yeah, I mean, I can't pretend to be any kind of, you know, big fan, but I did tell somebody that, you know, I did listen to Megan's new song, Her, and I like that song, and yeah, really some of Tory's songs I started listening to, and he's got that kind of R&B feel to some of his songs. But I'm kind of more of a, I told somebody, I probably will still always just go to old Deltron 3030 and Andre Nicotina songs on YouTube. Okay. Those are kind of my fallback, but I'm kind of a electronic music head, but yeah, I'm definitely interested in getting into it more. And part of it is just, you live such an isolated existence. I mean, I listen to, you know, podcasts and that kind of thing, but like, there's so much music out there that I'm not even really sure I have a way to get exposed to. So I'm interested in like a playlist if anyone wants to send it to me.
Yeah. That's everybody, man. Send Megan the Reporter, the playlist, and label it that, the Megan the Reporter playlist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel like justice was served?
I mean, in the end, I always like to defend the jury, because I always remind people that like, it doesn't matter what you think, and you're so focused on like one piece of evidence here and there, but in the end, 12 people were called to court. I mean, imagine being summoned for jury duty right around the holidays like that. And in the way the trial stretched on, I mean, they did exactly what they needed to do. They went in and they heard all the evidence, and then they talked about it. And I think some people were surprised that they were asking questions and stuff, and why didn't they just convict them right away or whatever. But in the end, I mean, they wanted to make sure, and the questions that they were asking really showed that they weren't focused on, you know, Tory's lawyer's personality or, you know, the personality of the prosecutors. They wanted to look at the evidence and make sure that they could be solid in their conviction. The way they asked to hear Sean Kelly's testimony, the neighbor who, you know, first identified the fight between the women, but then said Tory was shooting. And they wanted to hear the gunshot residue expert. I mean, they were obviously like just really focused on reaching a good verdict. So, I mean, if somebody thinks they did it wrong, it always just kind of frankly pisses me off when people start bashing juries and saying that the jury got it wrong and that kind of thing. I'm like, how do you know? You know, they did exactly what they were supposed to do, and they reached their verdict. And, you know, as somebody who went into the case really cold and heard that his apology call in the opening, I was like, what is this? I mean, what else could he be apologizing for? You know, exactly. I just feel like the case from the beginning always looked pretty basic. And I think prosecutors reminded the jury of that in the closing, where they said, this is actually a pretty basic case about a guy who, you know, fired 5 rounds at someone and then apologized for it.
Well, when you make it, you simplify it like that. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes that's hard for people to accept.
Yeah. And, you know, I will say that the whole, you know, justice was served, because overall, I mean, the jury reached the verdict and they did their job, but it was kind of alarming. And I don't want to say that I feel bad for anyone involved in the case, because in the end, Megan is the victim here. And the fact that people were trying to say that she wasn't a victim, and the way she was villainized was so stupid. But I mean, Tory also didn't get the best representation, you know, And I think it would have been a tough case for any lawyer, and he probably would be convicted, but his lawyer could have done a better job on some of that stuff. And it just feels like, especially for somebody with who I'm assuming has money, I was kind of surprised that he didn't have a better defense than he did.
Was a plea deal offered to him before the trial?
I don't know that for sure. I've heard that it was, and just from my experience with like criminal cases, they had to have offered him something. You know, it seems like most cases like that, there's some kind of offer on the table. So I haven't heard anything about what it could have been, but I'm like, oh man, depending on what the judge is going to do at sentencing, he might wish that he had taken that.
Yeah. Cause what he's facing after losing is, I'm sure, is going to weigh more than what he would have faced if he took a plea.
Yeah, yeah, totally. I'd heard like rumors that the plea offer was only like a couple years in prison, 2 or 3 years. I don't know that for sure, but I think it is safe to say that he's not going to get that little time when he gets sentenced. Yeah, we'll see.
And he's probably going to get deported more than likely. So I guess if he would have took a plea, he would have still got deported, right?
I'm not sure. Probably because it has to do with the felony conviction. So any kind of felony conviction would be like problematic for him for sure.
Yeah. Do you feel like the blogs who spread the misinformation about the verdict of the trial deserve repercussions?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I've always kind of subscribed to the saying that, you know, the solution to speech that you don't like is just more speech, like try to just talk about how that's wrong and get your voice out there. But I mean, Cardi B, who I covered a trial with her in Orange County before, a couple months before Megan Thee Stallion, and her lawyer on that case was actually the same lawyer who sued the YouTuber Tasha K in Atlanta, mm-hmm. who was spreading all these malicious lies about Cardi. And I mean, I'm kind of wondering if there's a kind of a case in that for Megan, because there's definitely some bloggers and some people that would be off limits. I mean, it would be kind of a waste of time for her to try to pursue lawsuits against, you know, and I'm even thinking just some of the people who are in the courtroom who maybe covered it a little slantedly, but didn't really do anything other than just do opinion journalism. But there does seem to just be some really malicious people out there who are, you know, saying things that are just kind of patently false about her, like kind of in the same realm as Tasha K. So yeah. I don't know. I'm like, maybe, and I've seen people saying, oh, on Twitter, you know, Megan needs to hire Cardi B's lawyer. I'm like, she should. It probably depends on the jurisdiction, because I know Cardi's lawyer is like Atlanta, Georgia based. So it would depend on, you know, what court they want to file any defamation lawsuits. But, you know, just off the top of my head, I don't know specifically who she would go after, but it does seem like the most extreme people who have been attacking her probably could be sued or held account. I'm not sure, but apparently her lawyer, Alex Spiro, has said that they're considering something like that, or they're looking into something like that. So it might not be the last we've heard.
A defamation lawsuit, right? I'm assuming.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It would be like defamation or libel or something like that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So what's next for Megan Cuniff?
You know, I'm actually starting a new gig. It's LA based. We're announcing it next week, but you know, Law and Crime was a great place and a great kind of national operation, but I'm excited to bring my trial reporting coverage to Los Angeles, like Southern California, journalism based, and kind of have more of a national audience for all the stuff that goes on in LA, like all the federal courts, prosecutions, because there's so much attention to like Manhattan, the Southern District of New York, because there's just so many media outlets over there. So any case over there gets tons of coverage, whereas there are a lot of prosecutions in LA that don't get any attention, even though if they were in New York, they would. So yeah. I'll be doing that. I did happen to just notice that T.I., the rapper, and his wife, Tiny, they're going to be in court in 2 weeks here in Orange County, and kind of like my home base, old stomping grounds courthouse, because they are in a battle with MGA, the toy maker, over the OMG girls, because T.I.'s stepdaughter was in the OMG girls band a few years ago with Lil Wayne's daughter. And then the dolls came out from MGA that look pretty similar to them. So there's a civil lawsuit over that, and it goes to trial in like 10 days. And apparently T.I. and Tiny will be in court. So I'll be tracking that. That should be fun. There's a LA city councilman who is going on trial for corruption next month in federal court in LA. So I'll be covering that. So kind of trying to just keep my ear to the ground on everything, and definitely keep covering Tory's trial too. I mean, I think the sentencing is scheduled for January 27th. I wouldn't be surprised if that gets delayed, but whatever the case, I'll definitely keep tracking it.
Yeah. Some serious muckraking you're about to be doing.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So last question. Why do words matter to you?
Because it's everything. It's what people hear. It's how we communicate. It's how we express. I mean, we express through vision. We express through all those things, but words can really get your point across. And you know, the way you say it, the choice, the words you choose, it all goes into, you know, proving your point. And proving your point is how you accomplish things and how you kind of cause discussions and get ideas generated.
Exactly. Love to hear that. So thank you, Megan Cunniff, for your work. Thank you for your contributions.
Thanks so much.
You know, I'm looking forward to seeing your coverage of the aftermath of the trial and your coverage on Follow You Now on Instagram and Twitter. So I'm looking forward to all of your coverage on high profile cases in the future. And yeah, man, thank you.
Great. Yeah. Thank you so much. I'll look forward to listening more of your podcast and everything. I love the focus on the words. That's the good thing.
Thank you. Of